Welcome to the podcast series, Intel on AI. Each episode explores human-centric topics related to artificial intelligence through conversations with leaders in the field. I'm your host, Abigail Hing Nguyen. Today, we're talking about where humans and artificial intelligence intersect. It's a broad category ranging from keeping humans in the loop of AI systems to human-AI collaboration to ways that AI can augment humans. With me today are two guests and researchers, Lama Nachman and Hanlin Tang from Intel's AI lab. Lama and Hanlin, can you each give a quick introduction so our guests can hear your voices?
Sure. So I'm Lama Nachman. I run multidisciplinary research lab at Intel that spans ethnography, design, and technology. And we're focused essentially on bringing AI into human AI systems that can help people in different aspects of their lives.
And my name is Hanlin Tang, and I'm Senior Director of the AI Lab here in Intel Labs. We are principally a deep learning research and engineering group. We both conduct fundamental and applied research in deep learning, build a couple of popular open source libraries, and also contribute to many of our Intel products.
Well, I'm so excited to have the two of you here today. So artificial intelligence is all around us. It's in our home devices. It's on our phones. It's increasingly making us more efficient with our digital tools and automating processes that we use at work. There was a study conducted a few years ago of 1,500 companies by the Harvard Business Review, and they found that the most significant performance improvements are when humans and machines actually work together. So I'll be interested to hear if you think that assessment is still accurate today. But where I'd like to start is, what are some other surprising or less well-known ways that humans are beginning to interact and even collaborate with artificial intelligence? And Lama, why don't we start with you?
So everything that we typically use online, you know, when you're working on, you know, documents online, when you're searching, when you're looking at your Facebook feed, all of these different actions that we take are actually mediated under the hood by a lot of AI algorithms. And, you know, more and more, we kind of see that, you know, even in things like education, and you look at tutoring systems and things like that, where, you know, people are interacting with content, but really a lot of that under the hood is actually using a lot of AI algorithms to try to figure out how do we optimize these experiences, what type of things do we surface to users, and how do we use some signals as feedback signals to these systems that can help personalize these experiences, optimize these experiences for the purpose of these users.
Ray, can you talk us through one of these educational options and what that would look like?
Sure. So, I mean, I would say if you use any of these tutoring systems, right, Khan Academy or whatever, you know, what ends up happening in many of those tutoring systems is that it's looking at things that relate to performance. It's measuring your performance, what type of content you're actually consuming. And then based on that, it's actually optimizing what type of new content does it surface and so on, based on also, you know, learning outcomes and things like that. Now, one of the areas that we've been looking at is how do you start to use these type of experiences in everyday life, right? In things where your interaction isn't just with a PC or with a computer system that we're actually being able to observe it through that, but you're actually experiencing things that are in the world around you. And we're using a lot of these signals in terms of how you're interacting with that world to help support that. So if I take the example of early childhood education, right? And actually, we're seeing that today in COVID, is that, you know, kids at these ages, we're talking preschool, you know, first grade, second grade, et cetera, they don't really learn by, you know, sitting in front of a computer and trying to do different exercises. They actually learn with their whole bodies, right? They interact with manipulatives, whether it's math learning that you're imagining, you know, you're learning ones and tens and you're putting these different objects together and then learning through that. So now if you want an AI system to try to, you know, help the student bring interesting problems, continue to advance along the same lines that I mentioned with tutoring systems, how do you do that, right? Because that's not an experience behind a screen that you're actually observing and manipulating. So a lot of the challenge there ends up with, you know, these intelligent agents need to be able to observe the space. You need to change that to a smart space. You need to be observing what actual actions people are taking, these kids are taking within those environments. Did they just actually put together the right objects to create that number of tens and ones as an example, right? And as they actually interact, it's actually quite interesting because the way kids interact is very different than how we speak to Alexa, right? I mean, if you watch the child kind of interact with these objects, they will nod their heads, they will point to things, they would laugh or move or whatever. And intelligent agent needs to be able to observe all of these things that are actually happening in that physical space and utilize, you know, that knowledge to help move that interaction and that experience further to achieve whatever the learning outcome is.
So it's a lot more organic interaction, visual cues.
Yeah, it's very multimodal. So we look at, you know, vision, audio, text, physiology. I mean, we measure things like, you know, heart rate. So all of these signals give you a lot of different inputs in the same way, frankly, that humans process this information, right? I mean, if you had a teacher or a facilitator that's working with a child, they're seeing all of these other signals, right? And that's what they're using to move that learning experience forward. So that's what we're trying to really mimic, is can we take all of these inputs from all of these different modalities, bring much more contextual understanding to these agents, and then enable them to interact with kids, you know, in these environments. As an example, if you look at education.
Right. That's fascinating. That's a very difficult problem to solve. And it's all in this microcosm of this particular issue. What about you, Hanlin?
I was going to say that, you know, what Lama mentioned about AI-powered machines needing to interpret human intent and react to that intent is not just in the physical space of education, but extends to other domains, such as in autonomous driving, where machines need to divine the intent of pedestrians as they attempt to cross the road, or in future applications, such as in manufacturing, where robotics and workers and human workers must co-work together on joint assembly problems. And even I think one application that we found most promising is also in surgery, which can involve many tedious tasks such as suturing, where in the future, you know, we have some collaborations to develop systems that can work together and potentially help relieve the tedium of some of these tasks and free up the human surgeons and their energy for the much more complex procedures. While that does require close interaction between the human and the AI, the ability for one to interpret the other, and also to interpret commands or requests that are being communicated between the AI agent and the human.
Yes, it does seem that managing the tedious tasks is one of the ways AI has been particularly useful as a complement to humans, because that not only reduces error and fatigue, but it frees them up for more of the creative and intuitive work. So what are some of the challenges that you're running into with these types of human and AI interfaces? And how do we collaborate with something that's still in process and is still being developed?
I would say one of the things that I've been really struggling with quite a bit as we think about how do we create these human AI systems is how do we make these systems more interpretable and explain its actions to the human, right? So one of the issues, if you think about it, is that today when we interact with other humans, there are so many different signals that we rely on to be able to understand, you know, why are the humans behaving this way? And more importantly, predict what they might be doing next. And as a result, you know, use that as a way to help us, especially when we're collaborating on a task, understand how we're moving within the space, how we're actually performing the task together, and so on. And today, that's a really hard problem from an AI system perspective, right? Because it can automate these actions, it will do these actions, but then trying to give that insight to the human that it's working with is really a hard problem. And even though you can't necessarily interpret everything or have the whole thing be explainable, there are certain things that you could probe to try to better understand why a decision was taken, right? So for example, what are the certain features that actually ended up influencing that decision that the AI system has made? Or for example, from within the data that it was trained on, what are the different examples of those that actually impacted that decision? Or further, you could actually look at some of the work that we've been doing around trying to get better measures of uncertainty of the inferences that the AI systems are making, trying to make that uncertainty essentially a first-class citizen in the design of the experience. So if you're thinking about, for example, mixed decision systems, it's really important not just for the system to tell you, you know, what the decision is, but to actually have a really good measure of, is the confidence level high enough in that decision? And where do I rely on the human to come in and bring more input here? Because that is more of an uncertain decision.
Can you walk us through a specific use case? So it's difficult to understand why a system decision was made. How do we then go about addressing that? And conversely, how do we refine the system's ability to interpret the human behavior?
Yeah. So, I mean, I kind of tried to touch on three different things. Take an example that Hanlin just mentioned, right? Which is driving. If you can imagine an autonomous vehicle that's driving, and then it is actually looking at a scene, and there is some level of uncertainty that it's able to quantify in what it's actually perceiving, right? So it's not really clear about what is that thing that's coming around the corner. One thing that it could do is actually use that as a way to decide, when do you actually bring the human in the loop, right? When do I actually ask for human help? And in that case, even transfer possibly the driving task towards the human to actually be able to do that. So in that sense, it's not necessarily what it's interpreting or what the AI system is able to do is tell you when it's not sure about what it is that it's inferring. And that knowledge about that uncertainty that gets given to the human is what enables the human to make a decision in that specific case to take control. Or if, for example, if you're actually analyzing a set of MRI images, it's the ones that the human really needs to look at and scrutinize because there is much more uncertainty within that data. That's an example of how you would use uncertainty in these human AI collaborative systems to actually not necessarily be able to make the AI system solve every possible problem, but recognizing that there's a long tail of problems that, you know, an AI system will not be able to solve, and even things that it will run across in real life when it's deployed into the real world that it hasn't actually been trained for. But if it's able to interpret that it has low uncertainty in that inference, then it actually can do something about it because there is a human there.
Right, right. Yeah, it's something I've talked about in previous podcast episodes, just the idea of having humble machines. They recognize when they don't have information that they need, and that's when they might need to check in with a human or bring a human into the loop. What about you, Hanlin? What are your thoughts here?
The central issue for me is that deep neural networks, which underlie most, you know, modern sophisticated AI systems, they operate on vectors of numbers, right? When they see an image, they don't see an object, just a stream of pixel RGB counts. So how do we take natural language, the most popular and expressive communication medium that humans excel at, and format it into something that's digestible to AI systems and that AI systems can reason over? Is in my mind, one of the biggest challenges. Just as a maybe a more specific example, one of the popular ways in which we teach robots today is by human demonstration. So imagine showing a robotic arm examples of humans picking up the red ball or gripping the green cube. This is a form of what's called imitation learning. And existing approaches really just show all the robot sees is this kinematics of the human picking up these balls and cubes. And one of our upcoming NeurIPS papers, Mariano and our team in collaboration with ASU have developed a way to include language in that form of imitation. So in that the robot not only sees the trajectory of the human as it goes and grips that green cube, but also integrates the command, you know, go to a green cube, go pick up a green cube. And in that way, the robot can respond to new and novel commands that it hasn't seen before. And we think this is an important step towards integrating natural language with kind of these deep neural networks that typically operate on vectors of numbers.
And Hanlin, can you talk us through solving the problem of, you know, you mentioned the human pedestrian that's crossing the street and they need to discern that intent. How do we approach that problem?
I think part of the importance there is collating the correct data set. I think oftentimes in machine learning, we think that extremely large data sets will be sufficient. But in this particular case, capturing all those edge cases is key. The human intent is often defined by, say, understanding the gaze of the person or of the pedestrian, whether they're looking at their phone or looking across the street or looking at the car itself. So by combining not just kind of the video itself, but additional submodules such as gaze detection or motion planning or motion prediction of the pedestrian, we can start building some of the key markers that can define the intent and teach the robot how to respond appropriately. The challenge is the type of inputs of the machine learning system that you want to create. It's not just about feeding a bunch of images and a bunch of labels. You have to be smart about including these additional components like gaze detection or predicting the motion, or is the person with a group of people that are acting together and you can reason over that to make predictions.
Yeah, and what's interesting in that space, I mean, there has been a lot of interesting work around, you know, probabilistic models where essentially you're looking at kind of the transition of these steps. So if you take the example of crossing the road, right? I mean, if you have a child that is there and there is a ball that happens to be ahead of that child, right? And so there's a lot that you could do about how is the scene progressing and what are the assumptions and what do the probabilities look like, and how is that model then gets built as the time progresses down, right? So the decision that one would make, I mean, just think about it as a human, right? The decision that we would make, if you see a child that's actually being held by their parents, right? You're going to worry less about, you know, stopping at a green light from when, you know, you just have the child on their own and there's like a ball that happens to be ahead. So some of the interesting work around probabilistic computing and probabilistic modeling is actually try to kind of continuously improve the set of assumptions in every time step to see, you know, how are you taking all of the evidence that you're seeing from the real world and then continuing to change what are the different probabilities of these different paths that you might be assuming as you progress down that time. So there's a lot of interesting models there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's certainly clear that just applying a very large deep neural network to the problem is not the solution, that for something that's so mission critical and that involves this kind of reasoning around causality, and we need something more than just, you know, a deep neural network applied to a large data set to be able to solve this problem. And that's what's exciting about, you know, these type of human AI collaborations and interactions.
I couldn't agree more either. So taking us now in a slightly different direction, Lama, you've done some very interesting work with Stephen Hawking. Can you give us a bit more about what that collaboration has been like? What are some of the problems that you're trying to address there? What's been hard about getting the AI to work with the human in this particular scenarios?
Sure. So the work there has really been in trying to enable people with disabilities to interact with their machine and as a result be able to essentially do anything that any of us can do and connect them to pretty much, you know, everything, right? Once you can solve that problem of being able to control your machine, you could probably control the world around you. So the issue there is that if you think about people who have ALS, there are two problems, right? One is, you know, as the disease progresses, they're unable to speak, right? So as a result, you can't use as a modality, for example, speech recognition as a way to control these systems. That combined with the fact that they really can't move any muscle, that means they can't really start to type anything or express their thoughts in any way. And in fact, they're dependent on their machine. So if they're able to actually formulate their thoughts into the machine, then the machine can speak on their behalf, right? But how do you do that? So now if you look at people with ALS, depending on the person and the progression of the disease, there are different parts of their body that they're able to still actuate that can then be used as a way to trigger a system. So think about, we want to transfer something to the equivalent of a push button, as an example, but we want to be able to use any signal from the body to do that. In the case of Stephen, he could actually use his cheek. So he could move his cheek up and down. And reliably, the best way to actually get that in the different settings ended up being having essentially a proximity sensor that sits on his glasses, that whenever he moved his cheek, it was the equivalent essentially of pushing a button with his cheek. And now you had to change all of the interactions on the machine to enable that one signal to allow him to do everything from writing documents to surfing the web to giving lectures to doing all of that from just the equivalent of that push button. Now, what's interesting there is there are some obvious technologies that you can utilize to try to reduce the burden of that interaction, right? So if somebody is actually only having that limited bandwidth signal, you don't want them to be typing a million things here, right? So you want to be able to, for example, do word prediction and automate a lot of the functions under the hood and bring a set of a few options based on the context of use, so that they can just select from one of n options, which makes it much faster than if they had to go to the mouse and, you know, go and click on something and whatever. So this is, you know, what we've done with Stephen. Now move forward to some of the later work that we've done. So even with the best of systems, the type of experience that you have when you're trying to interact with someone is that imagine somebody's going to say something, and once they're done saying what they said, then you're going to try to formulate that thought. And even with word prediction and improving that interaction, there's a long silence period that exists, right? From the time that this person finished their utterance to the time that you've been able to actually write the whole thing and then the system to start to speak it. So one of the areas we've been looking at, especially given all of the advancement in response generation systems, is actually, you know, what if we could have the system listen to the other person, listen to the whole conversation, and based on what that person said and what we know about the user, can we actually surface a set of different options for them to quickly select from, rather than turn that interaction to be a letter by letter or a word by word? Can we actually do the interaction at a much higher level and as a result, reduce the amount of time required to actually articulate a thought in response to something that it has heard? Now, the biggest challenge with this is that if you think about, you know, response generation systems, you know, and if you think about GPT-2 or GPT-3, I mean, you have these large systems that are trained on millions and billions of data to try to actually capture the most likely answers to a certain utterance. And that's not how people communicate, right? So part of the problem, as you start to really work with these systems in that context, right, what you're trying to do isn't have an autonomous chatbot that responds to the person, right? We're not trying to automate these people out of the loop. We're actually trying to enable them with tools that enable their voice to come out. So as a result, how do you make these systems controlled by the input of the user? How do you personalize something that is trained on millions and millions of utterances with a limited amount of data? The system will automatically generate something based on what it was trained with. The problem is, if you're given something as a user that is close enough, you're going to choose it.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah, let's say somebody, for example, asked me about my opinion about, I don't know, a presidential candidate, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you're formulating the answer, you know, it surfaces a certain set of options. You know, one of them is you think that their policy on healthcare is something that you're really excited about or whatever it is, right? So based on this information, you're going to see that the system, based on whatever it's trained on, it's going to surface multiple options to you, right, to choose from. And you can look at these three options and none of them is exactly what you want to say. So you, what is your option? Either select one of those three options that it surfaced, or you're going to go and write letter by letter, word by word, what your actual answer is, right? So the point is, you're going to be over time more and more tempted to select something that looks close enough to your thought, because that would be much faster to respond. The problem is, how do these systems learn, right? They learn by what choices you make. So every time I choose something that's not optimal because I just want a quick answer, it's going to reinforce what it just learned by my selection. It will say, ah, well, you selected this option. That's exactly what you would have wanted in that setting. So one of the things that we're doing is, well, can we indicate, as the user is selecting an option, if this is not an optimal answer, but they're selecting it for the purpose of expediency, they would just kind of indicate that to the system. And then when there is more time later, when you're not in the middle of a conversation, it can resurface back some of the things that it has learned and said, what would you have said in this setting, as an example?
Is this a design problem, like a survey design problem? Like, we're not presenting the right set of options that capture the user's experience?
Well, it's not a design problem, it's an AI problem, right? So because, like, the thing is, how do response generation systems work, right? I mean, it's like based on what you're feeding it as an input utterance and what it has learned from tons and tons of data that it has seen, the most likelihood of the answer given the question. I mean, just imagine when you're writing, I don't know, a Gmail email, right? And somebody sends you an email, you're going to see a set of responses. Those set of responses, typically, if you've noticed, right, they tend to be the most common possible answers.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about like auto completion of text.
Yeah, I mean, like when you go into your Gmail and somebody says, you know, would love to see you soon, and then it will just say, yes, for sure, or I would love that, or whatever, right? So those are the automatic answers that it will show that you can select from. Now, the reason this works is that it has learned on tons and tons of data over time, right, from these large data set that it has learned from. The problem that we're trying to solve is a different one, right? We're trying to bring the specificity of that user and the style of that user to bear. So in some sense, the interesting thing is really the intersection of the design and the AI here, because the point that I just mentioned is that, well, the AI system will generate things, right? The user will choose from them. But in a typical AI system that gets reinforced by these selections, it's going to more and more get the person into a space that they don't want to be in, right? So the design aspect of this problem, which is really why it's at the intersection of these two things, is that the design then becomes, how do we enable the person to actually capture that and later on continue to train the system in a different way, yet being cognizant to the constraints that are pushing them for expediency in the moment, as an example. So that's a design problem.
Fascinating. That's really interesting.
Yeah, if I may, it's a personalization problem. Yeah. We see similar things in audio, for example, where if you want to be able to generate speech that has the particular diction or style of a speaker, it can be difficult when the system has been trained on thousands and thousands of hours of hundreds of different speakers that may not really respect or contain your particular accent or your particular cadence of expression. And so it's a common kind of challenge with personalization and how you design that into these systems.
That's fascinating. So Hanlin, let's turn to you. Now, I know you've also done very interesting work. You have a project right now with Brown and DARPA. Can you tell us more about that collaboration?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. This is a DARPA program that's in collaboration with Brown University and also Rhode Island Hospital. It is a project to try to restore the ability of patients with spinal cord injury to be able to walk again. And that sounds almost science fiction-y, but the way we're trying to go about this is implant electrodes before and after that spinal cord injury site and use machine learning and AI to first decode the intent of coming from the brain signals of the person and then learn how to stimulate the post-injury site to be able to activate the right muscles to carry out the right kinematics that were intended by the user. You know, previously today, we've talked about kind of divining the intent of pedestrians and such. Here, it's much more at the microscopic level where we're trying to divine the intent from these neural signals that we're recording and then learn to stimulate the post-injury site. So think of it as like a intelligent bypass, as it were, of the spinal cord. And here, not only are there, I think, challenges on the sensor level, but also challenges on the compute level. How do you quickly be able to process 64 channels coming in, maybe even at 10 kilohertz, quickly enough to be able to do that decoding and do that stimulation inside the loop of a human trying to walk? And that is very challenging from a compute perspective. And that's what we've spent a lot of our time on here at Intel. But we've also worked with Brown on the algorithmic challenges, because to Lama's point, every patient is going to have a very unique system that's set up, because patients have injuries at different parts of the spinal cord, and they have their own neural structure for sending out a command. So we not only have to be able to train generally good models to do this, but also find a way to fine tune and learn from the human of each individual patient to be able to personalize a system that's actually functional and accords to the individual styles of walking of those folks. So those are probably the two principal challenges on the compute side. And then I'm building the right algorithms for the individual patients.
Right. So personalization, fine-tuning, that's the part that's hard to scale. How can we apply some of the work that you're doing at Brown to similar problems?
Yeah, it is hard to scale, absolutely, especially in kind of the medical domain with such stringent requirements on accuracy and fidelity and ability to restore, you know, walking, which is a difficult challenge. I think that the scaling comes in when we're trying to figure out, well, how long does it take? How many inputs do you need from a specific individual to do that personalization? And so I believe that some of the techniques that's being developed jointly with us, but mostly by Thomas Sayre's lab at Brown University, to try to accelerate that personalization process may prove to be useful in other domains. But that's still something that's kind of actively being researched and developed.
Mm-hmm. Right. Can you share a little bit more about what some of that research looks like right now?
Yeah, certainly. So this is currently only being done by Brown University in animal experiments, where they have these electrodes inserted and they're stimulating the spinal cord and then recording the EMG, so the muscle activity afterwards. And so now they build a model to be able to take the stimulation signals and be able to predict the muscle activation. And then they do some probabilistic sampling to invert that so that they can say, given the muscle movements, predict what stimulation is necessary to generate that. And importantly, this has to be done and personalized for each individual subject that they do the experiments on. So the challenge is, how do you squeeze that time to be much faster when that's both kind of a compute pipeline optimization problem and also an algorithmic challenge?
What are some of the safety concerns that you are seeing as we move forward with these types of collaborations?
Probably one of the difficult challenges is the problem of unintended side effects. We train these AI systems to optimize against a particular objective, such as maximizing the score in Pong or winning a chess game, or in robotics, kind of having an accurate placement of an object onto a manufacturing line. But there may be unintended side effects that we don't know about. So maybe in learning to optimize to place an object very accurately on a manufacturing line, they accidentally, say, overstep some of the safety boundaries that have already been set up physically in that location. Or maybe they take such a long time to do it that they might consume too much power of the system and require recharging much sooner. So like one approach is to say, hey, let's just exhaustively enumerate all of the side effects and teach the system to avoid that. But that can be very challenging to do and almost impossible in many situations. So one of the research we have ongoing in our lab, jointly with researchers from the Partnership for AI, is how do you teach systems to have unintended side effects without explicitly labeling those side effects? And the way to do this is around anomaly detection. So basically, you're saying to the agent, hey, go optimize to do this one thing, but avoid changing the environment as much as possible. And that kind of as much as possible metric is what kind of tries to keep the unintended side effects controlled. And that might allow for more scalable safety systems than making a long list and enumerating them all at once.
Right, which would be infinite.
That's right. Yeah.
Have you run into any corner cases where avoiding changing the environment is not the right fit?
It's still early days. There are very few AI environments that allow us to experiment with this. That's why we're excited when Partnership for AI built the safety environment for us to test with that. Mm-hmm. So it's still going to be determined as we build more and more complex simulations that allow us to measure these type of unintended side effects.
Lama, let's turn to you on the same question about AI and safety, especially if you're working in environments that are dealing with the vulnerable, such as the disabled and children. What are some of the safety issues that have come up for you and what are the ways we're addressing them?
One obvious problem, especially that we're talking about now, trying to collect tons of data from people in all of these natural environments that they're in, privacy is really a very big problem. And in very different ways, right? I mean, one is, you know, how do you limit the amount of data that you're collecting so that in some sense you're reducing the gap between what is captured and what is needed for the inference at hand, right? So one of the areas we've been looking at specifically, we've been doing a lot of work and trying to understand activities in the homes of elderly people, right? So this is to try to help people stay in their homes longer, but we need to make sure that they're okay, they're going about the normal things that they do like they've done before, because usually you could see a lot of changes in activities that are descriptive of degradation, either in health or social isolation and things like that. One of the things that we've learned is that, you know, you go and you put cameras in people's homes, the first thing that they're going to do is go turn them off. And that's actually has happened. You know, there was this big experiment that OHSU was doing, and literally that was the first thing that they did. They turned off all the cameras. So one of the areas that, you know, we think is quite compelling is actually using wireless signals to be able to infer human activity. You know, we typically think of wireless signals as signals that are used to communicate. But in fact, when people move in their environment, they do disrupt the wireless signal. So if you're able to actually take that data from the wireless signal and use, you know, machine learning to try to infer that from that noise on the wireless signal, what might actually be happening in the environment, you can start to actually understand what people's activities are. The nice thing about this is that what you're really trying to infer is activity. Having an RGB image of someone because you're trying to infer their activity isn't necessarily the only way of getting there. And trying to close that gap so that you're not collecting a lot of data that might be problematic is actually an interesting way of solving the problem. In other cases, you know, you could start to think about how do you reduce a lot of that data much, much closer to the sensor. So a lot of the being able to do the inference at the edge and, you know, retraining at the edge is really important because then you're exposing that data to a lower number of places.
It's a funny problem too, right? You're trying to collect data, but not collect data and trying to become more specific about what data we collect.
Exactly. And who do you share it with? And, you know, where does it go and what the provenance is of that data? Like we could have a 2-hour discussion on just privacy.
Just on privacy, right? Absolutely. So looking ahead in this space, Hanlin, what are you most excited about?
I think even though AI has made its way into many of our systems today, right? Recommendation systems online, autonomous driving that we've talked about. It still hasn't reached the level of human AI collaboration that I think we should aspire it to be. So when we think about what I mentioned around kind of surgery and relieving tedious tasks and free up our energy for creativity or more complex procedures, also in manufacturing, I think those are pretty exciting applications that are very close, and we may see things be rolling out over the next 5 years or so. There's another piece that I'm actually pretty excited about that is, I guess, lesser known, which is machine teaching, not machine learning. So typically, we will take experts, have them label a ton of data, and teach the AI to reproduce that human behavior. There's also a strand of work in the community on machine teaching. So in domains where expertise is very rare, can we actually use the trained AI system to now teach humans to be excellent and expert labelers?
How does that work? That's fascinating. I've not actually heard that term yet.
Yeah, it's a pretty exciting direction that many researchers are going after. So the way it works is the AI will actually produce examples that the human can now take and learn from. I think the trick is figuring out, well, what examples to expose that would best help the human learn. You might maybe start with a curriculum of kind of easy examples of, say, labeling cancer in x-rays, for example, or in CT scans. You might start with maybe the easier examples and then say, hey, look, we're going to go into something a little bit more challenging and make sure you cover all those edge cases and kind of react to how the human is learning to figure out what the right teaching images are to provide. And that's a nice twist on how we traditionally teach machine learning systems.
That's amazing. What about you, Lama? What are you most excited about in this field?
So, I mean, I would say, I think in some sense, we're at a point where we kind of need to decide where we want to go, right? And I think there is this narrative of, let's just continue to try to build something that mimics a human and, you know, put out there this notion of human AI competition. And how do we build something that really replaces the human? Or alternatively, we could look at this and say, well, the type of capabilities that AI brings to the table and the type of capabilities humans bring to the table are actually quite complementary. Mm-hmm. And how do we actually, from the get-go, think about building these human AI systems that can actually solve these problems of interest that we have? I mean, what I'm really excited about is the potential of actually making these technologies really work in the real world by actually going down that path, right? And to be able to do that, I mean, it is a challenging problem because now all of a sudden you have to have the machines really understand so many things about people because it's actually interacting with them. And it has, as I said, you know, one of the bigger issues is like, how does it also enable people to understand it more and why it's making these decisions and how to best interact with them? So I think that there is a lot of interesting areas around interoperability and explainability of these systems, about really tons of innovation in human AI interaction. And, you know, to me, one of the closest things to my heart is like, how do we eventually really build truly effective computing systems, right? Because at the end of the day, that's a big part of what interactions with other humans look like. And, you know, as you start to make systems that can understand human affect and use that as a feedback signal so that it can continue to learn in the real environment and in the wild, I think that will get us to a much faster rate of learning in situ, which today tends to really be the struggle. And that means they need to learn from users, not from developers only. That creates a huge opportunity for AI systems in terms of where can they be deployed in real world deployments.
Right, right. That interface is so important. And it seems like you're really tackling it head on with the work that you're doing. There's so much that AI can do that humans can't. It's faster often, it's more accurate, it's able to process these vast quantities of data that we would never be able to process. But then it helps to amplify our own abilities, our own leadership and creativity and empathy and art. And of course, we bring common sense and intuition to the table as well. Lama and Hanlin, thank you again for joining me today. It's been a pleasure to hear from both of you, and I'm looking forward to seeing what else comes out of your lab.
Thank you so much. It's a lot of fun to have that conversation.
Yeah, thank you. This has been great.